Good morning and welcome. My name is Brian Field, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with our guest speaker, Jarrett Burns. Please join me in thanking our musician today, Jose Lescano, and David Fleming. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Dr. Jarrett Burns, an assistant professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. Dr. Burns received his graduate degree from the University of California at Davis. Dr. Burns is a biology renaissance man. His interests have covered marine invertebrate ecology, systems modeling, and climate change. He's written articles for scientists on the power of the blogosphere and currently has an article out on crowdfunding for science. Dr. Burns uses information that he gathers in field studies to shed light on the impact of climate change. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jarrett Burns.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Brian. Thank you all for being here this morning. I'm delighted to be here today. I'm delighted in no small part because I cut my teeth as a marine biologist diving around here in the waters of New Hampshire at the University of New Hampshire and Cornell Shoals Marine Laboratory. So if any of you have been out to the Isles of Shoals, I'll talk a little bit about them later, but this is really my home stomping grounds, as it were. So it's my pleasure to be here and tell you a little bit about what is going on in the temperate reefs in your backyard. I'd like to begin with just a few more thank yous. I'd like to thank Joel Huberman for the invitation to come and speak here today, as well as the organizers. I would also like to thank a number of colleagues whose work I'll be talking to you about today, colleagues from the Kelp Ecosystem Ecology Network, and in particular the group on kelps and climate change. Their work really has informed a lot of my worldview and a lot of what I will be talking about here today. So today, I would like to tell you about the most interesting ocean ecosystem in the world. Oh, great, you might be saying. He's going to talk about some fascinating, fantastic, pristine coral reef. Maybe we're going to talk about somewhere in the Line Islands or Palau or somewhere warm and beautiful and gorgeous. No, not that. Coral reefs, been there, done that. And I say that with a lot of love for coral reefs. Many of my best friends are coral reef biologists, and they do amazing work. There are so many stories there left to be told, but corals. Okay, not coral reefs. What kind of reefs am I going to talk about then? Surely I'm going to talk about some bizarre, fascinating, new, novel habitat, maybe deep sea ocean vents, maybe the reefs that are created by falling whale carcasses colonized by bone-eating snot worms. I kind of wish I was going to talk about those. But I don't study them, so sorry. Today, I'm going to talk about something that I actually think is far more interesting. And I think it's interesting because it's something that is right here in New England, right here in our backyards. Heck, it's not just something that's here in New England, where we certainly have a model ecosystem of it, but something that we find around much of the world. I'm going to talk about the ocean ecosystem in your backyard, temperate reefs. Temperate reefs. What's a temperate reef? Well, if you were to jump into the waters off of the Isles of Shoals right now and go out to some rough and tumble rocky ledge, you would see that it's swathed in long, lasagna-like brown leaves of kelp. You would see it teeming with lobsters, football-shaped lumpfish, spiky urchins, and far, far more. If you were to go further out into the Gulf of Maine, say to Cash's Ledge, you'd find a kelp forest primeval, where kelps have long, luxurious stipes, where you still see cod and other species. It's an incredible ecosystem. And in fact, those of you who here want some pictures, I definitely recommend you look up photography by people like Brian Scarry, who are doing some really amazing work showcasing the beauty of these ecosystems here in New England. So temperate reefs are these wonderful rocky habitats in cold, but not too cold, waters, typically chock full of kelps. Kelps are a whole group of big brown algae that you see across the planet. And these kelps enable a wide variety of species to live within them on these temperate reefs. Here in the Gulf of Maine, we're lucky enough to have a fairly recent glaciation that left behind scoured, barren, rocky habitats that could be colonized by kelps and other species, building beautiful temperate reefs for us to enjoy and to also derive a large number of different services from. Okay, so we have these lush, rolling prairies of kelp here in New England. What about the rest of the world? Well, nearly a quarter of the world's coastlines are temperate reefs dominated by kelps. We have the branching, craggly, dark Lassonia forest of Chile, where they also have some giant kelps. There you have an amazing phenomenon like grazing fish that actually act like deer and mice that eat the reproductive parts of kelps, swim away, and then poop out kelp seeds somewhere else, allowing the forest to spread just like we have here with mice and deer. We have these almost, I guess the closest thing would be a truffula tree-like forests in South Africa of Aclonia maxima, stretching from the seafloor on up to the surface. Or we have mini bonsai palm tree-like forests in Australia and New Zealand, another Aclonia species. And then, of course, we have the kelp forests, which many of you may have heard about before, the giant kelp forests of California. Diving into these is much akin to diving in a cathedral or a redwood forest, where they host a huge variety of rockfish, sea hares, and a wide variety of other species. And in fact, those giant kelp forests aren't just in California, they're all around the world. You find them in Baja, in Chile, in Tasmania, New Zealand, and more. So you'll notice as I've described these temperate reefs, I keep talking about kelp forests again and again. While not all is kelpy in temperate reefs, in order to understand temperate reefs, we really need to understand kelp. Well, why is this? When it comes down to it, kelps are our coral analog in temperate reefs. These big, beautiful, delicious kelps. I'm going to pause right there because I said delicious, and that might puzzle some of you. Before I talk about this incredible order of algae, I just want to highlight why kelp is delicious. Again, I'm probably a little bit biased, probably from my experiences at last year's Seaweed Festival up in Maine. In fact, those of you who are interested, this August, go to Portland, look up the Maine Seaweed Festival. It's sponsored by Maine Sea Grant. It's great, and you will get things like kelp-dusted bagels, which are delicious. I had some tacos with a kelp providing a really nice salty contrast to the chicken and meat in them. Or actually, my favorite, and this may sound a little odd, but a kelp ginger citrus ice cream. It had a delightful salty sweet thing going for it and really was great. In fact, at the meeting, I heard the phrase, kelp, it's the new kale, come up again and again. And while it's not a kelp, we all may have just heard about the recent discovery of a species of dulse, a red alga, that tastes like bacon out in Oregon. So it may be coming to you soon, a nice vegan alternative to bacon, as it were. Actually, you know what? Many of you in this room may have eaten kelp. Who in this room now has eaten a seaweed salad, say at a Japanese restaurant? Seeing a lot of you. Okay, so what was that seaweed salad made of? It may have been these thin ribbons of bright green algae. Often that's kelp, sliced very thin and dyed. So you may have eaten kelp there. You may have eaten kelp in a soup as kombu. You probably have. There are a lot of other possibilities for kelp. There are huge kelp farms in Japan, Korea, and other places where kelp can form a real integral part of people's diets and is a wonderful flavoring agent. So I predict we are going to be seeing a lot more kelp in our foodie future. All right, so that's food. That's where I like to enter things, honestly, is food. I run a very food-motivated lab, as my graduate students will tell you. So I'm hoping that maybe that's gotten your interest in kelp going a little bit. But let's get to the really interesting stuff, their biology. What is it about kelps that makes them our focus for today? Well, first, as I mentioned, they are everywhere. They cover nearly a quarter of the world's coastlines, and anything that covers that much of the planet has got to be important. Wherever they're found, they are incredible habitat formers. They are what we call a foundation species. They create the base of any ecosystem in which they occur. They create habitat for fish, they create habitat for lobsters. They're a wonderful place for new little fish to come out of the ocean currents and settle in. And it's not just that they create habitat, they also feed the ecosystem. Kelps can grow enormously fast. Some of the giant kelps of California can grow up to 2 feet a day. Here in New England, we found kelps growing up to a foot and a half over the course of the summer. They put out an incredible amount of biomass. In fact, some of these forests are so large and stretch from the seafloor up to the surface of the ocean and can be seen from space. So a huge amount of biomass sucking up a huge amount of carbon dioxide. What is the fate of all of this kelp? Well, two things. First, obviously, it is eaten by a number of organisms. So live kelp can be eaten by things such as kelp crabs that you see scuttling up and down their fronds in some systems. Or, because it grows so fast, kelp often grows faster than it can be eaten and sheds a tremendous amount of biomass into the water around it. So this kelpy rain falls to the seafloor where it takes things like rapacious grazing urchins and instead makes them fat and lazy because they can just sit there and suck up all of this delightful kelp falling on them. Kelps don't just provide food and services to these organisms, they also provide a number of services to us, to people. I've mentioned food, of course, already. I've also mentioned that they can be channels for carbon dioxide. They also can do amazing things such as alter water flow. There's a great body of research in Europe looking at how kelps may actually dampen wave motion and can do things like alter shoreline erosion rates. So they provide services both to the organisms in the ocean, many of whom we end up going in and extracting and harvesting and eating in the end anyway. They also provide services directly to us. So at this point, I hope you're with me. And you're convinced that kelp is pretty awesome and that you want to do more or know more. So today what I'd like to do is take a bit of a walk around the world. And I'd like to tell you some stories about some temperate reefs that have taught us important lessons both about the present and the future. I'm going to focus on climate change as an organizing principle for reasons that will pop out as obvious as I go along, but also because climate change is something that is going to affect so many of us and affect any ecosystem that we come into contact with in the future. I'll start by talking about New England, and I will tell the story of our local kelp forests. I'll use New England to raise a number of questions about how climate change may alter kelp forests in the future. I will then move on and I'll talk a little bit about Australia. I'll really use that as an opportunity to answer some of these questions about climate change. And then I'll wrap up by taking us to California and talk about some more non-intuitive and, dare I say, sneaky possible effects of climate change. It's really interesting stuff, and hopefully some of you will have the good fortune to set foot in some of the ecosystems that I talked to you about today. All right, so let's start with New England, our homegrown backyard temperate reefs. New England is host to a wide variety of kelps that form these lush, rolling meadows, these prairies of the deep. Before the 1970s, a great deal of the Gulf of Maine was, in fact, quite kelpy. But as time wore on, many predators were fished out of the system. And grazers, like those fat, happy urchins that I talked to you about before, began to roam free. There was fewer and fewer species around to eat them. And as any of you know, who've been in areas where deer, for example, have built up in numbers, more and more deer, if you let any grazer go out of control, eventually they can have a real impact. And indeed, that's just what happened with urchins in many places around the Gulf of Maine, particularly some places that did not have a lot of wave action, began to actively roam and scrape the seafloor, often down to bare rock. They generated these absolutely incredible habitats that we call urchin barrens, although really if you were to dive on an urchin barren, it looks a lot more like a moonscape. So in the mid-1980s, going into the mid-1990s, with very few predators, we had urchin barrens predominating a great deal of the Gulf of Maine. Not everywhere, but it became quite common. So what happened? What turned the Gulf around? Well, it was a trifecta of three different forces. First, the removal of those predators actually led to some indirect effects. So predators weren't just eating urchins, but predators were eating things like crabs. As crab populations went up, many of these crabs love to eat little baby urchins. It's like eating popcorn for them. So as crab numbers built up, eventually they began to exert some regulation on those urchins. Second, disease. As we know from a variety of other urchin ecosystems, for example, the diadema urchins in the Caribbean, if you let urchins build up in numbers, often you'll find urchin disease. Nova Scotia actually provided a really great example of this, but we had disease running throughout many areas of New England and further north. And last, in the 1990s, we developed an urchin fishery. Again, I don't know how many of you in this room have eaten uni at a sushi restaurant. Those are sea urchins. As the urchin industry developed and urchin fishing picked up, urchin numbers declined. So great, we removed the urchins. Did everything recover back to its pre-urchin outbreak kelpie state? Not necessarily. In the 90s and early 2000s, and actually continuing to now, we've seen a variety of changes to the Gulf of Maine. Many of these areas that used to be kelpie have seen influxes of non-native species, such as the green alga dead man's fingers, which was quite predominant in a number of places throughout the 90s and early 2000s. Now we have other invasive species coming through. For example, one of the species that my lab studies forms what I like to call the red shag carpet from hell. It's a filamentous red alga, and there are areas the size of a soccer pitch that are absolutely covered in it. Or you have non-native tunicates, sea squirts coming in. You'll find large colonies of a species that's known as rock vomit. It's a really apt name. It really does look like the rock vomited up. You'll find large areas of that as well on rock walls and areas that used to be formerly covered by kelps or other non-native or other native species, excuse me. But all is not doom and gloom. We're at a really interesting time right now as the temperate reefs of the Gulf of Maine are full of vitality. We have seen kelps bounding back in many areas. In fact, in places where my lab works over the last two winters, it's been quite cold, and we've seen big, fat, luscious kelps, some of them, well, the size of me or larger. At the same time, we also know that change is coming. While we are seeing this patchy recovery of kelps in so many areas, what will the future bring as the Gulf of Maine and areas around it continue to warm? What will happen as things like storms and large storm-driven waves increase in frequency? There are a lot of possibilities and a lot of directions that the Gulf of Maine could go, and frankly, we don't have all of the answers yet. In order to start thinking about this and what some of those answers are, I'd like to actually take you to a more well-studied ecosystem with respect to climate change and temperate reefs, Australia. Now, I know when you think of Australia, you immediately think of the Great Barrier Reef, and you think of beautiful coral reefs. That's that coral fallacy again. Australia is actually way cooler than that. And I mean that literally. As you move south, we drop from tropical temperatures to much more temperate, cooler waters, and we begin to pick up kelp forests. So let's go for a moment to, say, Western Australia, where we have big beds of short, small palm tree-like Aclonia forests. It really is like diving in a miniature bonsai palm tree forest. This species of kelp is absolutely amazing. It's quite resilient to warm waters. In fact, the slowly warming waters of climate change in Western Australia have done very little to adult populations of kelps there. In fact, this is a kelp that's so resilient that you even find it showing up in Oman in the Middle East, where waters are kept just barely cool enough by monsoons every year. So unless you blast these kelps with tropical level heat, they're perfectly fine. Well, that's not entirely true. The adults are perfectly fine. But it's not just all adult kelps down there on the seafloor. Kelps have this wild life cycle. We often go out and see the adults, but they put out these microscopic, essentially kelp seeds. In fact, the seafloor of temperate reefs is littered with kelp seeds, creating a sort of seed bank. And the seed banks of kelps are often very sensitive to warm waters. We've seen that the kelp seed bank in Western Australia has actually declined in many places as waters have warmed. And this normally wouldn't necessarily be a problem. There are still many of these kelp seeds out there. There are many adults generating new individuals. But it becomes problematic when you have something happen like the heat wave of 2010. Now, we know that northern Australia is much more tropical, and periodically, these cores of warm water will shoot down the coast of Western Australia and create big disturbance events. A lot of adult kelps will die back as these warm tropical waters come through, and normally that's not a problem because the beds will recover. However, in 2010, when one of these warm cores shot down the coast, there were scant few kelp seeds to help reforest the bed. And when divers came back 1 year later, many of the areas that formerly had been kelp beds were now barren patches. In fact, in some of them, there were even corals. This phenomenon, the shift to a warmer water ecosystem known as tropicalization, is one of the big worries of many of my colleagues in Western Australia. If climate change continues to warm waters there, driving down the kelp seed bank and potentially increasing the frequency of these warm water incursion events, they may be up for a real problem. They may be up for a full-scale ecosystem shift. So that's one way that warming waters might alter temperate reefs. By reducing the kelp seed bank, they may actually reduce the resilience of these temperate reefs. We can see another way climate change may affect temperate reefs by looking to Tasmania, just south of mainland Australia. Tasmania is another wonderful system. They have a colonia forest, just like mainland Australia, but Tasmania is cold enough that it also plays host to the giant kelp, Macrocystis. It's the very same kelp species that we see here in California. What's astounding about giant kelp in Tasmania, however, is that it's rapidly disappearing. Since the 1970s, giant kelp has declined by about 85%. Around Tasmania. It has actually been listed as an endangered habitat type. So what happened? While there's some evidence that warmer waters in Tasmania may partially be the cause by depleting nutrients, by creating poorer conditions for these kelps, the big change has been an influx of sea urchins. Well, why is that a change? Why is that driven by warming waters? Previously, sea urchins on mainland Australia actually weren't able to get out to Tasmania. There's a channel of cold water that runs between them, and larval urchins weren't able to jump the gap. As waters warmed up, that barrier, that wall between mainland Australia and Tasmania fell, and larval urchins were able to cross the gap and come to Tasmania. This still may not have been a problem. There are a wide variety of urchin predators in Tasmania. It's the same species that you find on mainland Australia, where these urchins don't do nearly as much damage. But Tasmania is also host to a very vibrant spiny lobster fishery. So urchins were able to come into Tasmania. The larvae landed, matured, grew up into adults without anything there to really eat them in many places. And so just like here in the Gulf of Maine, these urchins went wild and were able to denude many of the pre-existing kelp forests. How do we know that that's really the case? Was it really this fishing pressure that drove these urchin problems that interacted with climate change to enable urchins to create barrens in Tasmania? Well, there's some evidence from marine protected areas. In Tasmania, a system of marine protected areas has been set up where spiny lobster fishing has been reduced. And there you find enormous, big, beautiful spiny lobsters. And in these areas, urchins get munched. In these places, you don't find urchins building up in abundance, and you don't find the grazing out of kelp forests. So we have this really interesting interaction between human activity, in this case fishing, and climate change, driving a shift in an ecosystem. It's very similar to something that we may potentially one day see here in the Gulf of Maine. What's also interesting about this example is that it shows that climate change on its own is not necessarily driving the whole show, that the slow warming of waters has to interact with some other form of stress to really knock back a kelp ecosystem. It's a 1-2 punch, if you will. So to understand the effects of climate change, we need to think beyond just the effects of warming. It's really about the interaction between the wide variety of different changes in an ecosystem and climate change. And that synergy is really important when we try and think about the future of our temperate reefs here. Okay, so we've talked about the effects of warming interacting with human stress. I want us to think beyond temperature for a moment. When I say climate change, I'm not just talking about warming, I'm also talking about other potential changes to marine ecosystems. So to think beyond warming, let's think about California for a moment. California, like Tasmania, is dominated by giant kelp. Although as you go further north, you find a different species of kelp taking over, this wonderful species that looks like a giant flail called bull kelp, extending from 30, 40 feet up to the surface. In fact, people take their stipes and they'll make horns out of them. And heck, even actually where giant kelp does exist, if you go into deeper water, say down to 100 feet, where giant kelp can't do nearly as well, you find what is my favorite species of kelp from the genus Pelagiphicus, the giant elk kelp. So elk kelps are this incredible species that will shoot up from 100 feet to close to the surface and then spread their arms out and have these huge leaves extend up towards the surface. Diving in an elk kelp forest makes you feel like a Smurf or a Lilliputian, just wandering around. You feel so small. Okay, so I've established that California is a kelpie wonderland. I had some good times working out there. It's a great place to dive. It's a great place to work. And one of the things that's so amazing about the kelp forests of California is the incredible diversity of life they host. There are roughly twice the number of species in those kelp forests than we find here in the Gulf of Maine. And those species are knit together through their predator-prey relationships into this wonderful, tangled food web. The way that food web is structured can affect the way that that entire ecosystem works, how many fish we can extract, how productive the ecosystem is, how carbon and nitrogen move through the system. That food web structure is really important, and I want you to hold on to that, because I'll talk about it a little bit more in just a moment. So if we're not going to talk about warming in California, what are we going to talk about? Storms. Waves. Records show that the biggest winter storm on the West Coast in California has been getting bigger on average since the 1950s. And this is right in line with a number of our models of climate change. In fact, if you look at a variety of buoys that have been recording wave heights around the world, you'll find this pattern repeated over and over again. Here in New England, we can even look at some of our wave records and see, at least since the 80s, increases in the frequency of these large winter wave events. So what do waves and big storms do in California? Well, you can think about a giant kelp for a moment. I haven't described them terribly well, so let's take a moment and think about them. Giant kelp are attached to rocks by large, knobbly holdfasts. From there, they shoot up and have, in some cases, 50 to 100 stems, or stipes as we call them, that go from 30 to 40 feet on up to the surface, and there extend out with blades of kelp covering the surface of the water. Sometimes you'll have 6, 10, 12 feet of kelp just lying on the surface of the water. So they're really big. When a big wave comes through, it exerts a lot of force on that large alga. Sure, a nice size winter storm may tear up some of those kelp stipes, it may rip up blades, it may pull a plant apart a little bit, but really, really big waves can actually come through and rip whole kelps off of the seafloor. In the 1997-98 El Nino, you had whole kelp forests in some cases being ripped up and deposited on the beaches that they were next to. So storm-driven waves can have a very large effect on these forests. What happens after a storm? Do these forests just bounce back? Well, if the waters are cool, they do. In fact, you can get into the water after a really stormy year, go diving in, say, July or August, and it's like diving in a dense jungle thicket. You sort of have to swim your way through, pulling kelp stipes back so that you can just get from one side of the forest to the other. But if the waters after these storms are a little bit warmer, too warm, recovery of kelps can be slow, and that can lead to some funky things. It can, of course, lead to starving urchins who, again, fat and lazy, were just sitting there picking up the rain of kelp falling on them, and then those roaming, grazing urchins can create problems, the same way they do here, the same way they do in Tasmania, the same way that these voracious, rapacious little spiky balls can anywhere. Or you can get different kinds of ecosystem shifts. In California, we see wild things like brittle star barrens cropping up. Brittle stars, for those of you who haven't seen them before, they're like starfish, except they have a very solid disk at the center and wavy arms full of hairs that they use to capture plankton and kelp spores as they come through. Or if you have a few years of calm afterwards, you can actually get sea cucumber barrens, these tiny, tiny little sea cucumbers, no bigger than your thumb, that reproduce locally, can actually spread out and occupy a whole reef. This is a little bizarre. There are some more typical state transitions, so you may find that a kelp forest that's been denuded turns into an algal bed. So those kelps, they shade the seafloor, and in shading the seafloor, there are a lot of algae that are denied light. Once they get removed by a big winter storm, many of these algae can go hog wild, taking up all of that light, filling space, and actually shading out kelps as they try and recover. So a lot of possible outcomes after a big storm, particularly if waters are too warm. If we think about climate change for a moment, and we think about the possibility of the increase in the frequency of these big wave events, what might happen, even if waters stay at a relatively nice kelp recovery-like temperature? Well, my research has shown that if you were to get year after year after year of large storm, as predicted by some of our models, we actually find yet another ecosystem shift in these kelp forests. We find that forests can flip to algae beds. We find that those food webs, those big, diverse reticulate webs that I mentioned to you before, can collapse down to something relatively simple that potentially may not provide all the goods and services that we enjoy from the forests. It's only one possible vision of the future, of course. Organizations like the Santa Barbara Coastal Long-Term Ecological Research Site are trying to figure out what the future of climate change really means for kelp forests in California. At this point, I've given you one possible answer, but really we have far more questions. How might these waves interact with warming waters, for example? How might they interact with other effects of climate change, such as ocean acidification? How might they interact with rapid changes in our urban coastlines? Does the recent addition of marine protected areas to California actually build more resilience into these ecosystems? These are all wide open questions. Moreover, there are still more questions. Could we see similar effects here? Could changing wave environments, such as we may see in New England, have similar effects to our local kelp forests? As I mentioned, we have a really, really different kind of kelp here. Instead of these big 30, 40, 50 foot tall giant kelps, we have something that's more like a 6 to 7 foot long lasagna blade hanging out and forming a prairie on the seafloor. Really different. And therefore, things like wave stress may have a really different effect here in New England. It's something that, with the help of MIT Sea Grant, my lab is actively chasing down. So at this point, I hope I've given you a lot of questions, and I hope I've inspired some curiosity in all of you about your local temperate reefs and the kelps that we find here in New England and indeed around the world. So I'd like to leave you with two things. First, a way for you to learn a little bit more. And second, a way that you can actually help. You can help me and help the entire research community understand how climate change may be affecting kelp forests. So first, what can you do to learn more? Well, I'm gonna play an evangelist for a little bit, for just a moment. I'd like to urge everyone in this room just to get out there. If you wanna know more about the temperate reefs right here in your backyard, go to the coast. Get certified to scuba dive. Go to Portsmouth Scuba, they're great. Get in the water. It's beautiful. We don't think about the Gulf of Maine as a fabulous dive location, but I'm here to tell you that that's wrong. It's just an incredible habitat. And by getting in the water and looking around, you will have a completely different view of the ocean around you. Yes, I admit it's a little bit chilly, but that's what wetsuits are for. Some of you may not want to go whole hog and dive, and for that, you can still snorkel. It's great. But you'll see something very different. And in fact, if you go one step further and find one place along the coast, one place that you are inspired by, that you find wonderful and beautiful, go there once or twice a year and look around. We're not able to understand change unless we see it with our own eyes. If you're able to go and visit the same place time after time, year after year, the amount of natural history that you will learn is tremendous. It will become your lens through which you view a constantly changing planet. Okay, get out there. But we all know here in New England, we have cold winters. We're not going to be getting out there all the time. Are there other ways that we can engage with kelp forests, with temperate reefs, with kelp forest research? There are, in fact. All of you in this room are potential citizen scientists. I mentioned before how giant kelp can be seen from space. Well, several years ago, a brilliant scientist who's now an assistant professor at UCLA, a man named Kyle Cavanaugh, figured that we can use satellite imagery that goes back into the 1980s to find kelp forests. And not just kelp forests in California, but Chile, the Falklands, New Zealand, islands around Antarctica. We can see these in satellite images. This seems like a great resource, a great way to go in, find out how kelps have changed over 30 years. However, there's a problem, and that is, that's a lot of images. And computers are notoriously poor at trying to pick out kelp from these images. In fact, computers will often think that a boat wake is a kelp forest. So we tried to solve this problem by throwing a crack team of highly motivated undergraduates at these images to circle all of the kelp beds they could see. And they got most of California done after a couple of years, and were pretty exhausted. So that obviously is not going to scale up to the planet. To go global, we need you. So we've partnered with the citizen science wing of the Adler Planetarium, a group called Zooniverse, and have a project called Floating Forests at floatingforests.org. where we ask people to look at some of these pictures, take a virtual field trip around the coastlines of the world, and help us just circle kelp beds wherever you see them. It's been an incredible experience so far. We as scientists hang out and talk with the citizen science on the site. We answer their questions about what they're seeing. We talk about kelp forest biology. We've even begun to collaborate with some of our citizen scientists. And after running it for only about a year, we've begun to see patterns in the data already. We can see the dieback of kelps in New Zealand. In fact, a lot of our early users were really bored when we showed them images of Tasmania because they kept saying, "Where's the kelp? I don't see any kelp. There are no beds here." We realized we'd only uploaded images from the last 10 years. And so as soon as we put in images from the 80s, there it was. So a very easy way to see that dieback. So please, come to the site, floatingforest.org, and start helping us to learn about how these giant kelp forests have grown and changed around the planet. those of you in the audience actually who are educators, we also have begun to provide curricula and teaching tools for teachers as well. We had a group of second graders recently who used the site for a while and made an absolutely wonderful little video about what they've learned about kelp forests. So okay, get out there. Help us out as citizen scientists. I'd like to leave you with three closing thoughts, three take-home messages. First off, I hope that I've convinced all of you that temperate reefs are pretty awesome. They're an incredible habitat, and they're one that is worthy of your attention, and one that you can go and take a look at tomorrow if you'd like, maybe this afternoon. Second, kelp is the new kale. It's also prettier to boot. So I hope you'll go away from here and maybe be a little bit curious and start to try some of the new kelp cuisine that's appearing around New England. And last, I hope I've helped to convince you that climate change can have some really interesting and sometimes difficult to understand effects. But these are potentially far-reaching effects that reach right into our oceans, right into the marine ecosystems in our backyard, our temperate reefs here in New England. So thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Burns. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience, and while the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. As a high school teacher with a student in the audience, how can I get my students involved in the Floating Forest Project, and what exactly would they be doing?
That's a great question. There are a variety of ways that students can become involved in floating forests. First off, just going to the site and looking around, we have a very simple task for students to undertake. It's looking at images and circling forests, and then we tell you something about what you've just done. We tell you how much kelp that you found in that image. We tell you when the image was taken and where it was taken. So I've actually used this in freshman level college courses, and I've had students go through and start to write down how much kelp are they seeing and where are they seeing it, at what time. And you'd be amazed, after only a few images, you begin to see patterns. You begin to see patterns across the years. You begin to see patterns across space. You begin to see patterns even within a year. In winters, maybe there isn't so much kelp. In summers, there's a lot of kelp. So there are a variety of ways that curricula can be shaped around those sorts of patterns that have to do with very basic kelp biology. Second, we have a site called ZooTeach. It's not ours, it's Zooniverse's site. So at ZooTeach, we are trying to actively collect curricula that educators are creating using different Zooniverse sites. And so we, at this point, we have our curriculum for elementary school students posted there already. And we're hoping to collaborate with high school, middle school, and even college teachers in the future to create more curricula to help students learn about kelp forests and use floating forests as a lens through which they can begin to interact with kelp forests. In fact, that's actually the biggest thing I'd say. It's a citizen science project. The science team that helped create Floating Forests is very invested in interacting with people. We're really excited about collaborating with high school teachers, with educators at all different levels, to try and find ways that we can help teach your students about kelp forests. So drop us an email. I'm sure we'll respond.
This is the big one, I guess. I'll give you the big question first. In the end, why does it matter if kelp beds change, other than the possible effect on our human population?
Mm-hmm. So why does it matter if kelp forests change? There are a number of reasons. Kelp forests form the foundation, or kelps in general, form the foundation of the ecosystems where they occur. So if we see a decline in kelps, we don't just see a decline in kelps. When we remove kelp from ecosystems, we see a cascade of changes to all of the other species in the ecosystem. So it's not merely that loss of kelps will affect services that you and I derive from kelps, but all of the other species will also change. They will lose habitat, and they will lose food. They will lose a place for their larvae to come in and settle. So we may see wholesale transition of these ecosystems were we to lose kelps.
Before we came out, we were talking about gametophytes. So the question is, you spoke about kelp seeds. Mm-hmm. Do kelps have a sexual process to produce those seeds?
That's a great question. So I talked about kelp seeds, and that was a bit of a simplification. Kelps have this pretty incredible life cycle. We call it a biphasic life cycle. What that means is that adult kelps are diploid, like you and me. They have two chromosomes. When kelps reproduce as diploids, they actually send out spores, and those spores are haploids, so they only have one set of chromosomes. Those spores, so this is an asexual process, and those spores go out and settle down on the seafloor and form these microscopic stages. That's what I referred to when I was talking about kelp seeds, but the technical name for them are gametophytes. And that's because each of these microscopic little gametophytes is either male or female. It's a haploid. Those gametophytes actually engage in sexual reproduction and create new diploid kelps. It's a really cool life cycle where most algae go through some really bizarre and interesting alternation of generations, some really interesting life cycles. In fact, unlocking those great variety of life cycles has been the key to unlocking algal aquaculture in some systems. For a long time, for example, it wasn't known that nori, what we commonly use to wrap seaweed, undergoes that alternation of generations. And so efforts to farm nori in Japan weren't successful until somebody discovered that the alternate life history phase of the algae, of the alga that is nori, Porphyra, looks nothing like the adult. It looks completely different. And once that was discovered, and they were discovered that they were the same species, it was only then that farming of Porphyra for nori could really take off. So it's a whole bizarre and fascinating area of biology. Algae are really cool.
Is picking up kelp floating in the water to bring home to fertilize our gardens damaging to the ecosystem?
It's a great question. So is picking up detrital kelp actually damaging the ecosystem? First off, it's not rooted down, but that detrital kelp will often have a fate. So detrital kelp can feed, as I mentioned, urchins or other species on the seafloor. Detrital kelp can get washed offshore, and in fact, for example, up in Nova Scotia, we find that the detrital kelp can get shipped offshore, fall into these deep water trenches, and feed a variety of the species there. We also find that kelps will often wash up onto beaches, and in fact, kelps can nourish beaches. They provide a food source for a variety of animals that can live on beaches. Picking up a single blade of kelp that you find and taking it home, probably not a big deal. But wholesale harvest, actually, harvesting can be done very responsibly. Again, as I mentioned, kelps recover very quickly, they grow very quickly. Kelp harvest is an active and growing industry, and there are a lot of interesting questions there. In fact, kelp farming has really started to take off in Maine recently. It's a really great industry. It provides a winter crop. It's a wonderful, wonderful source of food, wonderful source of fertilizer, as well as other products. So taking a single piece home, it's probably fine. But just recognize that that kelp is part of a whole tapestry, that the detritus can fuel a wide variety of other biological processes.
Okay, well, you've already answered one question, which is there a way to sustainably harvest kelp as a food source?
Yep.
So that was clever. Two with one. Okay.
Well, and I'd mention, I think that, you know, kelp harvesting has a very, very long history. You find kelp harvesting in Japan going back quite far. They have a very, very active kelp harvesting as well as kelp aquaculture industries. You find similar industries in Korea. And in fact, here in Maine, it's Maine Seacoast Vegetables does a wonderful and sustainable harvesting operation. Like I said, go to the Seaweed Festival and you'll really see the state of the art. Again, you know, my hat's off to Maine Sea Grant for funding all of that work into kelp aquaculture and kelp harvest. I think it's an interesting potential future crop for us, and we're seeing all sorts of great developments. For example, there was recently a Norwegian group that showed how the same kind of sugar kelp that we find here can be turned into biofuel quite efficiently. So a lot of possibilities for kelp.
Thank you. Okay, so does ocean acidity affect kelp?
Does ocean acidity affect kelp? That's a complex question, believe it or not, to which we don't have great answers yet. There are some studies that are just starting to come out that show that pH can affect, or ocean acidity can affect different parts of kelp's life history. However, I think the evidence is far from solid. What's interesting at this point is that changes in ocean acidity can affect a lot of the organisms around kelps. But at the same time, kelps themselves, by using a great deal of carbon dioxide, can actually alter local acidity. So there can be a halo of changes in acidity around kelp, and those changes vary from time of day to time of day, whether kelps are actively photosynthesizing and taking up CO2, or at night and when they are respiring. So how ocean acidification and changes in ocean acidity will impact kelps and kelp ecosystems, I think is actually a quite an exciting and open frontier of research.
And I've got another ocean chemistry problem for you. The effects of dilution due to Arctic ice melting, Greenland glacier diminishing, and Antarctic glacier shrinking, is this... change in salinity going to affect the kelp beds?
So will melting glacial ice or melting ice caps affect kelps? Again, I think this is a really great question. We've seen in some places the most immediate effect of melting ice on kelps isn't changes in salinity, it's actually having more light. So kelps in some places go all the way up into the Arctic. And there, many of these kelps sort of enter a quiescent phase over the winter as they're iced over. So there's no ice, there's no light, there's very little photosynthesis. Many of these kelps will then store up nitrogen over the course of the winter, and then when light comes in again, they'll begin actively growing quite rapidly. Some of my colleagues in Norway have found that those changes in light levels due to ice melting earlier and earlier can lead to quicker growth and can actually often lead to imbalances in the sort of carbon and nitrogen ratios in kelps and lead to them growing in some really funky ways in some places. They're adapted to deal with a certain amount of sunlight coming in a year. They're adapted to using their ambient nutrient stores. So changes in the timing of sea ice melt can have some very large consequences for how those beds grow and develop. In some places in the Arctic, we actually are starting to see kelps move in where they weren't there previously. Actually, this is a bit of a tangent. I find one of the exceptions that proves the rule about how climate change may affect kelp forests actually comes to us from South Africa. Due to patterns of ocean circulation around South Africa, parts of the coast there, rather than warming, are actually cooling due to changes in circulation from climate change. And in those cooling areas, we've actually watched kelp begin to move its range towards the equator. So it's kind of this fascinating phenomenon where this exception of a cooling waters kind of proves the rule of how changes in sea surface temperatures can affect kelps.
Thank you. Okay, so the final question is from me, and that is, could you tell a little bit about how you got involved in marine biology in the first place?
Sure. I got involved in marine biology from a very early age, basically shortly after birth. My aunt was a wonderful underwater photographer, and she spent a lot of time with me as a kid. And when we spent time together, often she would be going through slides from her last trip that she was either going to submit for publication or put together to give a talk herself. So I really grew up at her knee learning all about the ocean. And then I moved to Baltimore when I was still quite young, and my mother actually began working at the National Aquarium in Baltimore. So in some ways, I was kind of raised by the National Aquarium's volunteer department, you could say. So I spent a lot of time as a little kid just around the ocean, around marine biology. I started diving quite early on. Actually, that was a big transition. I began diving when I was 12 years old, and there is nothing quite like the first time you are down at 30 feet, breathing, and looking at the sea around you. It's a transformative experience.
Thank you. So thank you again, Dr. Burns, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
Thank you all. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Meg Peterson, who will speak about Reclaiming the Core, Education for Social Beings and Idea Creators.